Chapter 26. Gallows Cheats. Right up until the last moment, even as he mounted the steps to the gallows, he insisted his innocence. Someone else had murdered his employer, an elderly spinster, and his conviction was a nightmare mistake. But now it was all too late. Within a few minutes, John Lee's protestations would be cut off by death. The Reverend John Pitkin, the prison chaplain, intoned the ritual prayers for Lee's eternal soul. Lee's arms were strapped to his side, and a white hood was pulled down over his head and face. The hangman secured the noose around his neck, moved him to the centre of the trap, and pulled the lethal lever. Nothing happened. The executioner jerked the lever again, and again. Still, Lee stood waiting for death. That was the first stage of the Miracle in Triplicate, which was witnessed at Exeter in England on February the 23rd, 1885. A miracle which was to win Lee a very special place in the ranks of those who have escaped the gallows. Lee, aged 19, had been condemned for the killing of Ellen Keyes, once a maid of honour to Queen Victoria, who had employed him as a footman. She was an austere and wealthy woman who insisted that her servants attended daily prayer sessions. During the night of November the 14th, 15th, 1884, she went down to the pantry, where she was found dead early next morning by one of the maids. Her head had been battered and her throat cut with a knife, which Lee had been using. Lee slept in the ground floor room, adjoining the pantry. The maid said that she had been awakened by the smell of smoke and had found the body saturated in oil and surrounded by burning papers. All the evidence on which Lee was arrested and eventually found guilty was purely circumstantial. The prosecution suggested that his motive was anger over Miss Key's meanness. His wage was 4 shillings a week, but she had reduced it as a punishment for some trivial offence. There was fierce controversy in Britain over his death sentence, but that didn't save him from mounting the newly constructed scaffold on that February morning. There was Berry, the executioner, slamming the lever back and forth. Two warders started crashing their heavy boots up and down on the yard-square trap, but it still did not budge. The chaplain said afterwards, during those terrible moments John Lee stood firm, erect and unmoved, save for the jerks he felt from the violent stamping of the feet to push down the trap door. After 6 minutes of feverish suspense, the prison governor signalled for Lee to be removed. The bolts were examined by a carpenter and found to be working perfectly. The carpenter then shaved away the edges of the trap to ensure that it would not stick. A weight corresponding to that of Lee's body was placed on the trap, which opened immediately the lever was pulled. Lee, whose legs were also secured, was lifted back into position. Once again, the Reverend Pitkin recited the last words. Berry pulled the lever. Lee still stood there. Berry tried frantically, but the trap would not budge. Once more, Lee was lifted clear. 20 minutes passed while carpenters planed away more wood, and while a different engineer oiled the hinges, greased the bolts, and checked the lever. More tests were made. Each time, the flap fell with a crash. Lee was lifted back a third time. The chaplain, distraught with horror, was shaking as he hurried through the words of the prayer. Later, the chaplain said, the lever was pulled again and again. A great noise was heard, which sounded like the falling of the drop. But to my horror, when I turned my eyes to the scaffold, I saw the poor convict standing upon the drop as I had seen him twice before. I refused to stay any longer. Lee was taken back to his cell, and within hours he was reprieved. At his trial he had said, "The Lord will never permit me to be executed." After his triple escape he wrote, "It was the Lord's hand which would not let the law take away my life." He spent 22 years in prison. After he was set free he married and emigrated to America, where he died in 1933. Other people have escaped the gallows in even more remarkable ways. Miss Jessie Dobson, when she was the recorder of Britain's Royal College of Surgeons in 1951, stated in the respected medical journal The Lancet that the procedure employed in judicial hanging has been, and maybe still is, an uncertain means of causing instantaneous death. She described how the bodies of 36 criminals were dissected after hanging, and how pathologists found that in 10 of them, the heart was still beating. In 2 cases, the heartbeats continued for 5 hours. In 1 case, they continued for more than 7 hours. She cited examples of complete recovery after execution. One of them involved a woman who, in 1650, hanged for half an hour at Oxford jail. After she had been cut down, Sir William Petty, Professor of Anatomy at the University, and other doctors, arranged to start a dissection. Perceiving signs of life, they administered cordials, and the woman lived for a further 9 years, during which time she married and had 3 children. In 1728, a woman was hanged in Edinburgh, and her body was taken away in a cart by relatives. The jolting of the vehicle over the rough roads was apparently sufficient stimulus to restore her, and by the time it had gone 6 miles, she was almost well. She was still living in 1753. These escapes, like that of Lee, were regarded by many as evidence of divine intervention, as proof that the people concerned were innocent in the eyes of God. And that led criminologists to the heart of one of the central arguments which, through the generations, has been put forward by opponents of capital punishment. If it is subsequently discovered that a man has wrongly been committed to prison, he can be released and compensated with cash. But there is no reprieve from the grave. So how many innocent people have paid that final terrible price because of some failing in the legal system? How many men and women who, after being locked in the death cell, have been exonerated? Thomas Harris, the landlord of the Rising Sun Inn on the York-Newcastle Road, was executed for murder in 1819. Later, it was established that the killer had been a barman at the inn, the chief witness for the prosecution. Harris's posthumous pardon did him little good. One of the most controversial cases in modern times involved the mass murderer John Christie, the monster of London's Rillington Place. In March 1950, a young man called Timothy Evans went to the gallows for the murder of his young daughter. A second charge of murdering his wife had not been heard by the court. Evans, a simple soul, had protested that his wife had been murdered by the other man living in the house. Years later, the bodies of 6 women were found in the house, and the other man, Christie, confessed that he had killed them. This led, in February of 1955, to an amazing statement in the House of Commons from Mr. Shooter Ead, who, as Home Secretary, had refused a reprieve for Evans. He said, "I was the Home Secretary who wrote on Evans' papers, 'The law must take its course.' I think that the Evans case shows, in spite of all that has been done since, that a mistake was possible, and in the form of which a verdict was given in a particular case, a mistake was made. I hope that no future Home Secretary, in office or after he has left office, will ever have to feel that, although he did his best, although none would wish to accuse him of being either careless or inefficient, in fact he sent a man who was not guilty as charged to the gallows." The arguments about the execution of Evans continue until this day. What about the innocent people who have survived the death cell? Well, William Habron, 18, was just one of many. In 1876, he was sentenced to death for the murder of a London policeman. However, purely because of his youth, he was reprieved. 3 years later, while Habron was serving his life sentence, the notorious criminal Charles Peace, by then convicted of another murder, confessed to the crime of which Habron had been found guilty. The young man received a pardon and £800 in compensation. If Habron had been just a few months older, as old as 19-year-old Derek William Bentley, whose execution caused uproar in 1953, another irrevocable mistake would have been made. The circumstances of the Bentley case were extraordinary. He and 16-year-old Christopher Craig had been found guilty of murdering a policeman in Croydon, although Craig had actually fired the murder weapon. The law said that no murderer under the age of 18 could be hanged, so Craig was given a prison term and is now free. Bentley was sentenced to death by Lord Goddard, the Lord Chief Justice, although his had been a very secondary role. Men like Lord Goddard were staunch believers in the correctness of capital punishment, and 2 years before he sentenced Bentley, he told a royal commission that too many murderers were being reprieved. He was also firmly against raising the hanging age from 18 to 21 because it might be an encouragement to other young men. "I think it right that prima facie the supreme crime should carry the supreme penalty," he said. Had Lord Goddard been the man making the final decision, people like Oscar Slater would have been legally killed for crimes which they did not commit. In Glasgow, in 1909, Oscar Slater was sentenced to death for the murder of an elderly woman. He was reprieved. After he had served 19 years in prison, it was established that he was completely innocent and he was given £6,000 compensation. Once more, the more vengeance-happy members of the public were denied the thrill of a hanging. Executions have always attracted ghouls and the morbidly curious, particularly in those days when they were treated as family entertainment. The last public guillotining in France took place on June 17, 1939, when a large crowd at Versailles watched the beheading of the murderer Eugen Weidmann. The last public hanging in Britain took place on May 26, 1868, outside Newgate Prison in London, and hundreds of children were in the audience. The condemned man was an Irish political agitator called Michael Barrett, who had been convicted of having committed a murder while trying to blow up Clerkenwell Prison. The executioner, William Calcraft, did well out of the prerequisites of his job. He used to sell the clothing of notorious criminals to Madame Tussaud's waxworks show in London, as well as selling pieces of rope to souvenir hunters. Hardliners, such as Lord Goddard, insisted that capital punishment was essential because of its deterrent value, and because it was an expression of society's abhorrence of crime. "It is undoubtedly a deterrent, and all police experience shows that," he said. "I think there is a real fear among the criminal classes of capital punishment, and that is why it is not considered among professional burglars that it is desirable to carry weapons." On the question of irresistible impulse, Lord Goddard said that was a defence which might be put forward by every woman shoplifter. He relished the story of the prisoner who pleaded kleptomania and was told by the judge, "That is just the disease I am here to cure." Men like Professor Terence Morris, however, one of Britain's leading criminologists, forced the country to abolish capital punishment for every crime except that of treason. And for treason, a man could be beheaded in Britain up until 1973 if hanging was considered too good for him. Professor Morris says, "So many factors are not considered by the hangers and the floggers and the others who howl for more severe punishments. They should, for a start, stop assuming that criminals, and I'm thinking particularly here of youngsters, rationally calculate the penalties. In some degree or another, most people who commit premeditated violence are unbalanced. They also tend to lack the capacity to anticipate punishment, or to recollect it. The real criminal also has a great deal of the gambler in his make-up, and he tends to take the view that it will not happen to him, at least not this time." A classic example of this attitude was seen on November 10, 1960, when two young men were hanged in London. Norman Harris, 23, went to the scaffold at Pentonville Prison, while his friend, Francis Flossie Forsyth, 18, was executed a few miles away at Wandsworth Prison. At about 8 o'clock in the morning, an hour before the death time, a discharged prisoner came through the gate at Wandsworth and said that Forsyth could be heard all over the prison screaming, "I don't want to die! I don't want to die!" Both men had been found guilty of kicking another man to death. News of the double hanging was heard on a car radio by 20-year-old Victor John Terry of Chiswick, London, another small-time criminal who had been a teenage acquaintance of Flossie Forsyth. Almost exactly an hour after Forsyth died, Terry walked into a bank in Worthing in Sussex and shot a bank guard in the head. His defence against the charge of murder was that he believed himself to be a reincarnation of the legendary American gangster Legs Diamond. He stated to a psychiatrist, "When a person dies, his mind leaves him and goes into another body. My mind was from Legs Diamond." In other words, it was not Victor John Terry who had decided to carry a gun on the bank raid. It was the long-dead Legs Diamond. Diamond had issued the orders to the body of Terry, and Terry's trigger finger had done no more than respond to instructions from beyond the grave. It would not be unusual for Terry to have had an interest in or an obsession with Legs Diamond. Third-raters often identify themselves with big-timers in the same walk of life, rather like a small-time repertory player daydreaming himself into an Olivier or a Brando. In Terry's case, the alleged hallucination would probably have been aggravated by the fact that he had habitually taken drugs. None of that, however, saved him from dying on the same scaffold as Forsyth. Lord Goddard, who argued strenuously for the hypocritically macabre ceremony of the black cap, which was initially worn as a sign of mourning for the condemned man, would have regarded the stories of Terry and Forsyth as powerful evidence for the retention of capital punishment. He also scorned sentimentalists who suggested that women should not be executed. And he said, "I do not understand that point of view, especially in these days where equality of the sexes is emphasised in every way. Some of the most shocking cases of murder have been committed by women." Women, however, have finished on the gallows for crimes far less serious than murder, crimes which, in some cases, they almost certainly did not commit. Mary Squires, who almost died because of a corset she did not steal, provides just one chilling example. Her story is an important one, for it underlines the appalling dangers of such an irrevocable punishment. An 18-year-old girl called Elizabeth Canning mysteriously disappeared in the Houndsditch area of London on New Year's Day 1753. She was considered to be extremely respectable, and her baffled family organised an intensive search for her. All in vain. Then, late one evening, exactly 4 weeks after she had vanished, she arrived home. She was filthy, hungry, and exhausted. The clothes that she had been wearing were gone, and she was dressed in an old petticoat and shirt, covered with a bathrobe. Where had she been? Her story was tearful and confused. Two men had seized her in a dark street, ripped away most of her clothing, and forced her to walk for miles and miles until they had reached a bawdy house. There were three women in the kitchen of the house, and they had become extremely angry when she refused their invitation to work for them. One of them had taken a knife and slashed through the laces of her stays, before bundling her upstairs and locking her in a hayloft. There she had lived for a month on bread and water, which she had conveniently found there, until she succeeded in loosening a wallboard and escaped. Then, in her half-starved state, she had walked some 10 miles home. Who were these women? Where was this house? Elizabeth could not remember. The ordeal had wiped such details from her memory. Why had she not sought help or refreshment on the way home? Because all she could think of was getting to the safety of home as quickly as possible. From which direction had she come? Through her hysterical sobbing, she told them, as far as she could remember. One of the neighbours questioning her, a young man called Robert Scarrett, recalled that there was a house which might well fit her scanty description, owned by a woman called Susanna Wells. Elizabeth Canning immediately seized upon the name. Yes, she was certain. It was about Susanna Wells that she had heard while she was in captivity. The following morning, at the insistence of her family and friends, she told the whole strange story to an alderman. A warrant was issued for the arrest of Susanna Wells. A posse of law officers and family friends then escorted Elizabeth Canning to the house, where they found 5 women and 3 men. She was asked to point out those who had robbed her of her stays. Ignoring Mrs. Wells, she indicated the heavily cloaked figure of an old gypsy woman who was smoking a pipe. "That old woman over there by the fire, she was the one!" The gypsy, Mary Squires, threw back her cloak and revealed the frightening deformities of her face. Her nose was grotesquely big and misshapen. Because of a glandular imbalance, her lower lip was swollen to the size of a hosepipe. Her skin was scarred with scrofulous tumours. This was a face straight out of a nightmare, a face which surely no one could ever forget. Yet Elizabeth Canning had never before mentioned that there had been anything unusual about it. Mary Squires screamed and protested that she had never seen the girl before, but she and all the others in the house were taken to prison. Public opinion was hopelessly biased against them. They were gypsies and people of low morals. Besides, a woman with such an evil face would obviously be capable of any crime. Mary Squires insisted that she had been more than 100 miles away in Dorset on January the 1st. But one of the house prostitutes, a girl with the unlikely name of Virtue Hall, tried to save herself by going back on her original denials and turning King's evidence. Now she was testifying that Elizabeth Canning's story was true. That clinched the fate of Mary Squires. She was sentenced to be hanged at Tyburn Tree. Susanna Wells, for harbouring and protecting a thief, was to be branded on the hand with the letter T. The sheriff's men, anticipating the sentence, were ready with their irons. The mob howled with delight as the metal seared into Susanna Wells' flesh. But the Lord Mayor of London, Sir Crisp Gascoigne, intervened before the hanging of Mary Squires. He was uneasy about the whole affair, and he petitioned the King for a postponement until further inquiries could be made. For 15 months, Mary Squire stayed in prison while investigators scoured the west of England for witnesses who could support her alibi. Then it became obvious that Mary Squires had been telling the truth. Even more important, other evidence showed conclusively that Elizabeth Canning had lied about her entire disappearance and had never been to Mrs. Wells' house before that day when she had gone there with the posse. There was talk that she had left home for those 4 weeks to have a baby in secret and had invented the story of abduction. But that was never proved, and even after her conviction for perjury in the spring of 1754, she refused to tell the truth about her lost month. Elizabeth Canning was sentenced to transportation for 7 years to His Majesty's plantations in America. In November 1756, she married a man called John Treat at Wethersfield, Connecticut, and it was there that she died in 1773. It's alarming to reflect on how many people must have been punished, some suffering the ultimate deterrent, because the world breeds liars like Elizabeth Canning. On the other hand, innumerable murderers have escaped the gallows because courts have decided that their crimes were so horrifically bizarre that they must have been conceived in madness. That was the category into which 18-year-old Ernest Walker, a footman in a house in London's fashionable Lowndes Square, was placed. His motive for murder, which to his twisted mind seemed completely logical, ranks as one of the most macabre on record. He wanted to die so that he could be reunited on the other side with the mother he had adored. But he was terrified by the prospect of going alone to the grave. He wanted a companion in death. In April 1922, he began making his plans with the elaborate thoroughness of an obsessed lunatic determined to make a spectacular gesture, a gesture which would show the world how important and how clever he really was. For in Walker, there was that curious mixture of callousness and childish conceit which is so often found in killers. He wrote down his scheme on a sheet of paper torn from an exercise book, detailing every action in the manner of the items on a shopping list. At this stage, he didn't know who his victim would be, but that, after all, was a trivial detail. On that dark journey into death, anyone would do as a companion. He decided that when he had the house to himself, he would telephone the district messenger company in nearby Sloane Street and get them to send him a boy. This was his timetable for murder. Number one, ring up Sloane Street messenger office for boy. Number two, wait at front door. Three, invite him in. Four, bring him downstairs. Five, ask him to sit down. Six, hit him on the head. Seven, put him in the safe. Eight, keep him tied up. Nine, at 10:30, torture. 10, prepare for end. 11, sit down, turn gas on. 12, put gas light out. 13, sit down, shut window. One Saturday, when the other servants had the evening off and Walker's employer was in Ireland, a 14-year-old boy called Raymond Davis died according to the dictates of the timetable and of Walker's lunatic mind. But the boy died alone, for Walker avoided that last journey. By the time Walker reached item 13, his conceit had melted into cowardice and he bolted from the house. His earlier determination to win posthumous respect was emphasised by a letter he'd written to the butler headed The Fatal Day. The letter read, "I brought him to the pantry and hit him on the head with a coal hammer. So simple. Then I tied him up and killed him. I killed him, not the gas. Then I sat down and turned the gas full on. I am as sane as ever I was, only I cannot live without my dear mother. I didn't half give it to that damn boy. I made him squeak. Give my love to Dad and all my friends." However, as he fled from his blood-drenched death companion, he had forgotten his visions of fame. The sadism had drained from him. In its place was sheer terror. He wanted to get away, as far away as possible. He took a train from Charing Cross Station to Tunbridge in Kent. As the miles increased between him and the boy's body, his fear became tinged with elation. He told himself, Ernest Walker had done what the ordinary, dull, humdrum little man could never do. He had demonstrated his power of life or death over another person, and that was a godlike power which put him on a higher plane. But those people he passed in the Tunbridge streets, they didn't even know. They had no idea of what a superior man he was. He wanted them to know. He wanted them to be amazed by his greatness. So he stopped a patrolling policeman and told him all about it. At the Old Bailey, he was found guilty but insane. In 1937, only 15 years later, the medical authorities considered it safe to discharge him from Broadmoor Hospital. The man who had yearned for death and who had murdered in his desperation to reach it was set free to start a new life. He and the others before and since his time had avoided the executioner and cheated the gallows or the electric chair. But Walker and the rest, the ones who were actually guilty, had not escaped all punishment. Shakespeare rightly said that conscience makes cowards of us all. But it does more than that. It turns them into their own hangmen, with the memory of the murders they committed, the rope around their necks.